From NPR News, I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. The March on Washington, 50 years ago this summer, has been credited with turning the tide of the American civil rights movement. A quarter of a million demonstrators turned out on the National Mall. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his I Have a Dream speech, and the Civil Rights Act was passed the following year. Meantime, another less visible revolution was taking place on transistor radios across the country. From member station WCPN, David C. Barnett brings us that story.
The summer of 1963 started off with a tune by a singer who had helped forge a path into the mainstream spotlight for African-American performers a decade before.
Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Those days of soda and pretzels and beer.
Nat King Cole sold millions of records in the 1950s and was the first African-American to host a nationally broadcast TV variety show. Lazy, Hazy, Crazy Days of Summer would turn out to be the singer's last hit song.
That particular record was not our cup of tea, if I can remember.
Herb Kent was a disc jockey at WVON, then a new station in Chicago. It featured a totally African-American programming staff and leaned heavily on the music coming from a young black-owned record label based nearly 300 miles to the northeast.
See, Motown sound was like you did the music first and then you did the vocals, so the music drove the records.
Herb Kent says Motown president Berry Gordy used WVON to test the label's new records and artists. But even though the station's call letters stood for Voice of the Negro, Kent says they weren't just going for a black audience.
We had a bunch of white listeners to our black station back in the day, and we would program some songs to attract them. You know, we were in the ballgame to win. I played Dion and the Belmonts from time to time. It's My Party, Leslie Gore. We played that. We were just kicking butt.
It was also an interracial dance party at WHK in Cleveland.
Spotlighting next, Johnny Holiday.
Top jock Johnny Holiday recalls that a number of black artists were starting to appear on his station's Fabulous 50 song list in 1963.
We knew by playing those kind of records people would tune into our radio station. We did check the R&B charts of the R&B stations, and if there was something that was just going completely nuts on their station, we might slip that in our little top 50 list and see what kind of response we got.
This wasn't just happening in Chicago and Cleveland, says Craig Werner, author of A Change Is Gonna Come, Music, Race, and the Soul of America.
The racial divide between what people were listening to diminished steadily through the late 1950s into the early 1960s. It doesn't mean that there weren't some differences remaining, but at the center of the musical hit parade, black folks and white folks were listening to very largely the same thing.
Our day will come.
And occasionally, a performer's racial identity got a little confusing.
When Our Day Will Come first came out, a lot of people thought I was a white girl until they saw us in person.
Sitting in her living room in Akron, Ohio, Ruby Garnett says her group, Ruby and the Romantics, toured a lot behind their first hit record that summer of 1963. And Craig Werner suggests that audiences were receptive to more than Garnett's silky voice.
You get a song like Our Day Will Come. You get a song like One Fine Day. Even though those songs were not written with a political message in mind, they resonated with the energy of the civil rights movement, what people were feeling politically. They're looking ahead to a better future.
No tears for us. Think love and wear a smile.
And Ruby Garnett says you might even get a message if you look closely at the two hands clasping on the cover of her album.
It's a white hand and a black hand. That meant we're going to have everything and we're, going to be together.
Our day
In suburban Cleveland, 15-year-old Steve Golders was intrigued by something very different. Today, he's an editor for a local TV station and recalls that he and his friends were Beach Boys fans when they heard folk music coming out of the radio in the summer of 63.
Peter Paul and Mary's very popular. We were starting to appreciate it. We were starting to like it. We were starting to learn what it said. And that's something to be said, because going from Little Deuce Coupe to If I Had a Hammer or Blowing in the Wind, is that's a leap.
How many roads must a man walk down before they call him a man? How many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand?
Peter, Paul and Mary's version of Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind was sitting at number 2 on the Billboard music charts at the end of August 1963. Peter Yarrow has vivid memories of playing it to the demonstrators at the March on Washington.
It was a heady time, and when If I Had a Hammer broke for a hit and it became a top 10 hit, we felt, well, music is changing. It's not Shrimp Boats Is a Coming. And it's my party, and I'll cry if I want to.
But music scholar Craig Werner says that's the point. It was Leslie Gore, the Beach Boys, and Peter, Paul, and Mary.
You're hearing all of that right next to each other, and that, I think, is what makes it really wonderful. If on some basic level the civil rights movement is about freedom, it's about the freedom to be who you are, to not fit yourself into a niche. And I think you really feel that in the soundtrack of 63.
There was another song about social justice starting to move up the charts as the summer of 63 came to a close. It was a Latin remake of a Peter, Paul and Mary hit, which in turn was a remake of the original version by the Weavers a dozen years before. Trini Lopez's take on If I Had a Hammer may have been protest light, but it had a message and a good beat. You could dance to it. For NPR News, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
You can hear more than 100 songs inspired by the civil rights movement at nprmusic.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.